Live from Petone in New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. G'day everybody, good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be in this on this planet of ours. You've managed to find the top New Zealand podcast about movies. We are rated number one, the best and most listened to New Zealand movie review podcast. It's Cinematica, so you're in good company listening to this roundup of reviews, news and opinion about the world of cinema. We're going to help you decide what to go and see next weekend and get the best value out of your cinema dollar. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio are
Simon Weary
and Kaylee Carruthers.
Excellent. Pleasure to have you back, Kaylee. Are you refreshed after your bit of annual leave?
Yes, refreshed. I just took 2 days off, and I'd like to just do a refresh to next week once we're done with the intro here.
Okay. Every week, the three of us gather around this beautiful Formica table to review all of the latest releases, talk to interesting people about what they've been watching, and we keep a close eye on what's been happening around the world too. Films and stories that we're looking forward to in today's program. Simon monkeys around with Project Nim. I'll get my... Who wrote this? I'll get my vamp on with the latest installment of the Twilight Saga. Kaylee will try and keep her head above water with Submarine. And we'll take a look at the dirty history of United Nations peacekeeping in The Whistleblower. And this week in New Zealand on Thursday, a new feature-length documentary is released about the Christchurch earthquakes. And that documentary is called When a City Falls. And a little bit later on, we'll be speaking to the director and co-producer of that film, Gerard Smythe. So all of that and more in this week's edition of the Cinematica podcast. But first, what have you lucky New Zealanders, what have you been watching? It's time for the New Zealand Top 5.
Yes, hello, and welcome to the New Zealand Top 5 with your weather girl, Kaylee Carruthers. I'm back from my two-day holiday. So, coming in at number 5 this week in New Zealand, we have the Inbetweeners movie. Number 4 is Drive. Number 3, In Time. Number 2, Contagion. And number 1, all you Twihards showed up and did your duty. And number 1, Twilight Saga.
And does it have a dollar value beside that? How many people's pockets are lighter as a result?
That requires math that I can't
trust. Close to 2 million. We got 1.9.
1.9 Twilight million Saga bucks.
Over 4 days.
In New Zealand.
Which is, you know, it's a pretty competitive number when you compare it to some of the other opening films like Harry Potter Part 2, 2.9. Transformers, Dark of the Moon. 2.1 over 4 days, so it's right up there.
It's right up there, but it's not looking like it's going to be the number one film of the year, though, is it? On that basis,
yeah. No, I think you Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 will probably still hold that spot.
Right, and in the UK, it on a 3 day weekend, because they open their films on a Friday, £13.9 million. For Breaking Dawn Part 1, which is, again, not to be sneezed at. And internationally, I actually had these figures at hand a little bit earlier on. And where are we? An opening weekend internationally of $283 million.
Mm. Not a bad start.
Yeah. Do you get the feeling that we're in the wrong business?
Mm. Mm.
And
really, though, if somebody come to you and told you, I want to make a movie about these... this werewolf and a vampire, and this woman is torn between the two of them, and it's really kind of...
Yeah, you're right, actually. Yeah, I would have told them to go jump in a lake, actually. So, unfortunately, or fortunately perhaps, we are going to have to discuss the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1 a little bit later on. But before we get our teeth into that subject, we're going to look at a documentary. It's called Project Nim, and we'll have a little bit of audio from it when I get the right screen up, and then Simon will be telling you all about it.
him going from being this meek little huggable toy to a robust young chimpanzee.
He's going to be big. 5 to 6 times the strength of a man.
He's got fangs.
This is 37 stitches.
In that sense, he was becoming more chimp-like. It didn't seem to be a cause for alarm. I had never regarded him as a child. I regarded him as a scientific project. Nobody keeps a chimp for more than 5 years.
Project NIMH. This was a big hit at the New Zealand International Film Festivals earlier on this year. Simon, it's very fresh in your memory because you saw it this morning.
I did, yeah. No, I checked it out this morning. Brought to us from the team who made the Oscar-winning Man on the Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And based on Elizabeth Hess's book, Nim Chimpsky, The Chimp Who Would Be Human, it's a very interesting documentary about this project in the 1970s where the study of this young baby chimpanzee takes place. And it's really to do with, I guess, the goal of sort of, you know, nature versus nurture and how you could teach this chimpanzee to do sign language and communicate with humans. But along the way, it's sort of, you know, this poor old Nim goes from different sort of environment and experience, you know, along the way in terms of like, you know, he starts off with this family in their house and it's kind of a bit kind of weird.
He sort of lives like a human baby in Manhattan, doesn't he? And
yeah.
He's got free reign of the house and he gets to play with Lego blocks like the kids do, and the kids love him and what have you. But there's no structure, is there?
No structure whatsoever.
They're not measuring anything. They're not even really properly teaching him sign language at that point.
No, and it's yeah, it's kind of a bit frightening in the sense that, you know, this chimpanzee will be living with his family, and there's all these pets and little babies, and, you know, there's a family of, I think, 7 children, you know, and they do talk about these moments where he's quite, you know, violent, and but it is a very loose environment, and they shift him out of that environment into a more sort of I don't know, classroom type environment where they can study him and teach him and teach him sign, and they make rapid progress in teaching him sign, and it's quite interesting to see how he picks all this up and learns it and demands things and asks for things and does interact with the people around him.
But it all goes wrong, doesn't it? Really, well, it certainly goes wrong for Nim.
It does, and I found it quite a hard watch. I didn't find it a teary one, but I found it quite a hard watch because it was more reflective on the people.
Yeah. It's about the difference, isn't it, between animals and humans, and we're supposed to be elevated. We're supposed to be a bit above that sort of thing, and yet we treated him pretty shabbily.
We do some awful things, but also I thought that this kind of academic kind of arrogance or sort of drive to just sort of achieve their goals at whatever cost, and that's what they do, and they really kind of, whilst Nim has this character, he's still a project, and he gets manipulated, and it's uncomfortable viewing in places.
Yeah, it's really a documentary about human ethics more than anything. I mean, you get to the story of Nim Chimpsky, but it's really kind of examining the ethics of the humans involved in this experiment and how he was treated, which is quite, makes it a bit difficult to watch at times.
There's only a couple of people in there that you'd actually kind of like. You know, there's a lot of people that you don't like, and there's a kind of, the relationships that go on between the people are kind of a bit odd as well, I thought, you know, given that it's meant to be a scientific environment. I thought the lead sort of project manager of, I've forgotten, Terrace.
Yeah.
He was kind of, you know, it was all business for him, and he was quite manipulative. He
used it to build his own profile pretty spectacularly, didn't he? He only ever really showed up when the media were around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's this telling moment near the end of the film where, I mean, Nim's been put in this place, which is pretty awful, for over a year, and he just comes back basically after a year to get a photo shoot and then just leaves. And Nim just goes nuts, you know, like this is his last sort of, he's been in this kind of prison, you know, sort of this world of a prison, and this was his last glimmer of hope, and then he just turns his back and walks off, and he reacts like a child would. You know, he has these massive temper tantrums, it's very sad, and like you say, it's about ethics, and the ethics in this are pretty pretty ordinary, I thought, in terms of how the people behave.
Yeah, I watched it about a week after I saw the Planet of the Apes movie. And they would make a fantastic double feature, actually, because, you know, you watch the two together and you think, well, actually, one's a fictional version, of almost the same story. And, you know, human beings, we don't come off very well in either of them. Mm. So, two words, Simon.
Deeply affecting. is what I'd say.
Kaylee?
And I'll say Oscar-worthy because it has been shortlisted for the top 15 Academy Award nominees for 2011 for documentary.
All right. Well, my two words for Project NIMH are heartbreaking. And, you know, we recommend it, don't we? I think that people who are interested.
Oh, we do. And it's great to see a doco like that, isn't it? I mean, they're not
intelligent and very, very well researched. My only problem with it, I thought, really was while there was a lot of original footage of NIMH and they obviously documented a lot of what went on, I'm not really mad keen on the sort of recreations where they sort of put actors into rooms and create these sort of shadowy worlds. And you think, it's like, if you don't actually have footage of it, try and work your way around it. Don't try and recreate it. But that's my only slight problem with a film that otherwise was very, very affecting. We're going to stay on the subject of chimps because the next film that we're going to talk about is, in fact, not a lot of people know this, but is, in fact, the result of what happens when you stick a million chimps with typewriters in a room.
You're so bad.
So coming up, we're going to be talking Twilight.
I, Edward Cullen, take you, Bella Swan.
For better or for worse.
To love.
To cherish. As long as we both shall live.
The fetus isn't compatible with your body. It's too strong and fast growing.
It's crushing you from the inside out.
Your heart will give out before you can deliver.
You did this.
I can't see Bella's future anymore.
We don't know what they bred. We have to protect the tribe before it's too late.
Protecting the tribe, the Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn Part 1. And this is the fourth of the Twilight films. I have had the fortune, the good fortune, of watching all four of those films. I worked it out a little bit earlier on that that means that I've spent 493 minutes in the Twilight universe.
And how much money?
Well, luckily, as a film reviewer, I managed to sneak in the side door. I don't think I would have ever left any money behind if it was entirely up to me. But of that 493 minutes, 492 of them, I was wishing I was somewhere else. And the latest episode doesn't really change that for me. Now, I recognize that these films, a bit like Harry Potter, are critic-proof. They're absolutely reviewer-proof. As we discussed a little bit earlier on, the money just keeps pouring into them. And there's nothing I can say that's going to dissuade or persuade people to go and spend their money somewhere else. These are films that are made for the fans, or in fact, fans of the books primarily, who have now become fans of the films. And they don't appear to care that there are narratively slack, that the acting is pallid, that the characterizations are... I don't know. I could go on, but it's actually not going to change anybody's opinion. But what I will say is that of the four that I've seen, this is the least crap.
Really?
It is. Yeah, seriously. The last two, nothing happened for a long, long period of time. Like at the beginning of the second film, he asks her to marry him. And then at the end of the third film, she finally says yes. So that's, you know, it took two films to get from there to there. At least in this film, there's a few things actually happen. They have the wedding. It's the longest wedding in any film that I've ever seen that doesn't actually have the word wedding in the title.
No, it was really embarrassing, but I was actually crying through the whole wedding scene. And I don't know if it was because I was in physical pain from watching Twilight or if I was just really over emotional.
Was it really beautiful, the wedding?
It was. It was a very beautiful wedding. And you know, it's who wouldn't want to be married in the forests of British Columbia? Hello. Beautiful.
Oh, okay. So maybe I was a bit homesick. Right. So there's a little bit of Canadian homesickness
going
on.
It's interesting because, I mean, some of the critics have come out and said that this one's just in a holding pattern and it doesn't really show too much.
At the very least, at the end of it, something dramatic has happened. Like her transformation that has been threatened. That's a bit of a spoiler for those people who really care. Her transformation, which has been threatened from the day that she met Edward Pattinson's character.
Robert Pattinson's
character.
It could
character,
be Edward Pattinson.
Cullen.
He might as well just change it.
Anyway, Edward Cullen, from the day they met, the threat was always that, you know, if you get too involved with this character, you will turn into a vampire and your life will never be the same. And it's like, you can't let this happen. Your life will be over, blah, blah, blah. And backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards for months and years. Anyway, it's finally happened. So at least we can move on to the gigantic battle with Michael Sheen, which I expect is going to happen in the next film, because that's what they were prefiguring for us. So I'm very cynical about these films like Harry Potter, where they, in order to extract even more money from a gullible public, they split one book into two films. Because, and that really is, it's just entirely cynical, isn't it?
But well, it is, but it's kind of worked. I mean, if you look, you can't argue with the money. I mean, nothing's flopped in that sense. You know, they've tried it and it hasn't really flopped.
And she just sits around for most of the movie being pregnant. And I don't know how.
Takes a long time.
I'm not sure how you come to term in like 4 days after missing your period or something. But that's impressive.
No, it's because his seed is so powerful.
I'm gonna be sick.
But, anyway,
but hold on, for the audience, for that target market. Yeah. You know, for the supporters of the books and the previous films,
if you take
your head off and you say, how does it fit for them?
Here's the thing, is that I think a lot of them will have gone to see it. A lot of them will have done what is expected of them. I don't know how many of that audience are actually satisfied with what they've got. I sat and watched the film on Thursday at a cinema in Wellington, and there was an awful lot of fidgeting and looking at phones and getting up and walking around.
To be honest, it was phones.
I am not entirely convinced that that audience, even though out of loyalty to the books that they're fans of, whether they were actually entirely pleased with what they saw.
I'll have to take my daughter, because she's, you know, a big fan and she hasn't been yet, and get her sort of take on it.
I think you should have done that before today, actually.
I know, it would have been wise.
Anyway, two words on Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1.
My two words are can't unsee, and also we got a tweet for a two-word review from Rochelle J. Becker, who I also work with, which is great. And I love this. Her two-word synopsis of Twilight was vampire cesarean.
Excellent. Not too much.
Thank you, Rochelle.
Spoilerage there. My two-word summing up of the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1 is breaking brains. It's time for some news.
Yes, thank you very much. Welcome to the news desk. I would like to start out today just by prefacing something that was mentioned last week on my absence. Simon, you referred to Ian as my man friend, I believe.
Is that wrong?
Well, it just sounded a bit...
I thought that was very respectful.
I thought it sounded a bit salacious. Like, I was taking a day off to meet my man friend who's been overseas.
Your gentleman caller.
I just meant that he's your man friend as opposed to other friends.
My mom listens to this.
Yeah, but... doesn't she know about him?
Yeah, she does say that. She loves him. But anyway, it was my partner who was overseas at the Abu Dhabi Film Festival. So everyone knows, I'm not a hussy.
A very cool festival. Very cool.
Yes. We wouldn't dream.
Lots of cash flying around.
So has anything happened actually in the world as opposed to just sort of in your world?
In my bubble. Yes, lots of exciting news headlines. Let's start off with Ethan Hawke saying he's planning another Before Sunrise sequel with Julie Delphi and Richard Linklater. Now, anyone who's watched the extras on those DVDs, as I did not too long ago, because I watched actually the two of them together for the first time, they would know it's actually, I think there's... they were planning 5 films or something. So, of course, 10 years apart. So
I'm a big fan of those, and that's actually very, very good news as far as I'm concerned. They're two characters that I think they're doing a fantastic job of watching them age, and I think that they're going to do a very sensitive job of the transformation. So, yeah, I'm very happy at that. And actually, I can also recommend that if you ever get a chance to see any of Julie Delpy's films herself, they're worth checking out too.
Yes, and another title she is doing was just announced, a music bio was announced today.
She makes records too. I've actually got one of her albums at home. She did some of the soundtrack.
Singer.
Yeah.
That's the last
thing. It's kind of annoying, isn't it, that degree of talent in one person? Anyway.
As I mentioned earlier, on Friday, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced the top 15 documentaries that will advance in the voting process for the 2012 Academy Awards.
Easy.
Nominees include Project Nim, as we just reviewed, Bill Cunningham, New York, Pina, and If a Tree Falls, all of which were screened at the New Zealand Film Festival over the last 2 years. Let us know who you would like to win or be nominated. I'm a bit upset that Senna didn't make in the top 15.
Yeah, no, Senna should be in there. That's a crime.
And there were also two Werner Herzog documentaries, one of which we've seen here in New Zealand and still playing, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Both of those overlooked by the Academy, and it'll be interesting to know what the reasoning is behind that. But you know, the Academy, you know, we love to give them kudos when we agree with them, and then we dismiss them, don't we, when we don't agree with them
because they're out
of touch, completely out of touch.
My pick out of all those, yeah, it's Bill Cunningham. You heard it here,
right?
He'll pick up the Oscar.
Well, and is it still playing? Is it still playing in several places in Wellington?
Around the traps, it is. Yeah, no, it is. It's still
so there is still an opportunity for people to go and see it. Bill Cunningham, New York. That is Simon's pick out of those 15. So, yeah, interesting. We await with interest.
Yes.
Put money on it.
Yes.
Put your money on it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Former Oasis member Liam Gallagher says that his film about legendary band Beatles will be mega. You may have heard of them, yes, small band. The 39-year-old is working on a movie about the British musical legends, and although he hasn't cast anyone or secured rights to use the group's music, he thinks fans will enjoy the biopic.
I'm a bit worried about this.
Which one's Liam? Is Liam the singer or is Noel the singer?
Oh, I can't remember which one's the bigger spaz.
You know, I've still got a grudge against these guys because I remember going to see them in Wellington here and they had a fight and walked off. And I remember giving up going to see Radiohead for these guys. And I've never. So I'm sorry, I won't be checking out his film.
Okay, well, that's a totally understandable personal response. There are a couple of documentaries that I've seen about the British music scene. One is called Live Forever, which was about Britpop and the 90s sort of Britpop explosion. And also there's a film that was on recently about Creation Records. And Liam Gallagher, I think it's Liam, whichever the smart one is, the guy who wrote the songs, not the singer.
He's the older one, isn't he?
The older one, yeah. Easily the smartest person on screen in both of those, very, very astute and aware of his own position and the ironies in his own role in the industry. And he also seemed to get the music business better than anybody else. So it wouldn't surprise me if it doesn't come up with something worth watching, even though it might just be me watching it on my own. Simon won't pass on any of his money.
No, not for that.
No. Okay.
No. So the biggest news today, it was exploding all over Twitter, Sylvester Stallone is planning to bring his Rocky days to the stage. It is reported the actor is working on a musical version or versions of the Rocky film franchise. Rocky the Musical is slated to premiere in Hamburg, Germany in November 2012, after which Stallone will take an English version to stages around the world. So the most American of all film series is actually premiering in Germany.
How are they going to do that when he runs up the stairs? Because it's quite a long way he runs.
Yeah, he's going to have to keep singing.
It'll rotate around and around and it'll keep going like a treadmill.
Maybe, an escalator.
Adrian!
Whenever I hear stories like this, I am brought to mind the Simpsons version of Planet of the Apes. So I can't take it seriously, sadly. But my best Sylvester Stallone piece of news this week was the reveal of the poster for The Expendables 2. And I got very excited when I saw that because Chuck Norris is in it.
Oh, great.
So they have and Jean-Claude Van Damme. So they've really gone to town in terms of the 80s action heroes. If there's ever a must see, Expendables 2's got to be it.
Right. All right, and in Twilight news, I couldn't help, I had to add this. Police in Illinois arrested an extremely upset 18-year-old girl on Saturday after she told authorities that she crashed her car because her boyfriend did not take her to see the new Twilight movie. She was incredibly intoxicated and had rolled her car off the motorway in Illinois.
See, I think that this is an example of the bad messaging that's coming out of that Twilight movie, because if Twilight, the movie, was actually about modern, independent female role models, she would have paid for her own damn ticket and she wouldn't have waited for her boyfriend to
take
her.
She would have been driving a Volvo. She would have been fine.
Well, there you go. So many lessons from one story. Thank you, Kaylee, for the news.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. Any tips, incidentally, that if you want to share with us, you can do that via Twitter or our Facebook page or via email. You can get the address at cinematica.co.nz, which is our website. So if you think there's anything that we're missing out on, any news that we haven't stumbled across, let us know, because we do want to make sure that we cover all the bases news-wise. On Thursday, across New Zealand, a brand new feature documentary opens at around about 50 different cinemas across the country. Very rare for a New Zealand documentary to get this sort of attention. It's called When a City Falls, and it's about the recent earthquakes in Christchurch and the people of Canterbury's, I guess, response to them and how they are going about bouncing back. We spoke with the director of the film, Gerard Smythe, a little bit earlier on. But first, a few little bits of audio from the film.
Christchurch, New Zealand city of the plains. Here, when spring comes to Canterbury, daffodils bloom gay and golden in the woodland of Hagley Park.
Christchurch has had a massive earthquake.
And I just ran for my son.
Come to mummy, Isabel, come to mummy.
The feeling was somebody's looking after us. We have been big time blessed.
I mean, they say, you know, there's not going to be another 7.1 earthquake, but there could be one in 5 minutes' time also.
We've been joined in the studio by Gerard Smythe, who is the director and producer of When a City Falls, which is the documentary that's just been released about Christchurch. And the, I was going to say the earthquake, but that's simply not accurate, is it? It's the multitude of earthquakes,
yeah,
isn't it, Gerard?
The 7,800 earthquakes, I think so, yeah.
There's a lot of earthquakes to fit into a two-hour movie.
It is indeed. Just a small correction, I'm a co-producer with Alice Shannon.
Right.
Made in Christchurch by Frank Film, made by lots of people in Christchurch.
Well, that's right. There are an enormous number of people's names on the credits at the end.
Yeah.
I get the impression that it's not a film that could have been made by one person. How did it come about? Can you tell us that?
I started filming after the September the 4th earthquake, and for the next 5 months we got together a feature which was locally financed. We tried Film Commission, but they weren't interested at that stage, and it was locally financed privately, and we thought a feature documentary, which we can make quite cheaply these days with digital cinema, put it into Christchurch cinemas. We thought we could get our money back doing it that way.
So the intention was always to go to cinema rather than to think about sort of television?
Yeah,
or
absolutely.
Right.
And we had just made a fine cut. I think we got it down from 15 hours to 2, something like that. And boof, February the 22nd happened. And it sounds odd now. I was sort of in two minds. Whilst I carried on filming and ran into the city within minutes, I was also very depressed about what we'd just done, thinking that's of no use anymore. And it took nearly a week to go, well, hang on, you know, there is that three-act structure when, you know, act one it gets bad, and then when it can't get any worse, it gets worse. And so we thought, wow, yeah, of course.
And did you look at each other wondering, well, have you hit rock bottom? You know, is this the point of redemption?
We hit many rock bottoms. Rock bottoms kept coming over the year. They haven't come for a wee while now, although last night we had an earthquake for the first time in about 2 weeks that I felt one. And, you know, the adrenaline comes back every time. So we don't know, but, you know, we sort of suspend disbelief every week that we don't have one. We inch closer to not thinking about it every day, you know.
Mm. Sorry, Simon.
Oh, so is normality restored or no?
Never will be.
Never?
Well, I don't know about normality. Mm. You quickly find a way of living, but it's a very different life to what it was beforehand. You know, there's that slightly hackneyed phrase, the new normal.
My wife's from Christchurch, and she went back for the races not long past.
Did she?
Yeah, yeah. And she was just saying when she went to the city centre how disorientating it was, because there were no landmarks left, no buildings.
Well, that's the funny thing about Christchurch is that it's nearly all a grid pattern without hills, or like Wellington or Auckland. Volcanoes are landmarks in Auckland, you know, and bluffs in Wellington. In Christchurch, it's flat, and buildings are landmarks, and they're gone, and you just don't know where you are. And that's often said now. We just... not sure. A friend of mine came back to Christchurch last week for the first time and didn't realise they were lost, but didn't realise they were in Colombo Street.
Yeah, yeah. And this film, is that, because I mean, my experience has been purely through the TV and radio, I guess. And this film, though, seems to dig a lot deeper and really sort of expose, I don't know, the devastation in a lot more detail and the sort of the hurt that everyone's gone through. With that.
Yeah, I think so. It's more of a grassroots street level view. I live fairly centrally, so I was behind the cordon in the early term red zone. So I had to, you know, be home by 6:30 every night and go past tanks and show people my passport and so on. Anyone else in that area had accreditation and was sat on a bus and taken to places for 20 minutes and all the media's, world's media, got off the bus. They were all here till Japan happened. In February, it was just dozens and dozens and dozens of you know, faces from around the world. And they would be, you know, shepherded around the red zone. But I lived there. So I was sort of reasonably illicitly just doing my own wee thing. And policemen were saying, hey, who are you, son? And I'm going, well, just home movie, live in the street.
I watched the film last Monday, and I'll confess to you that when the February earthquake struck, I was sitting at home in Wellington on the computer doing some work, and the Twitter feed immediately sort of went into action, and there was this disaster, and I switched the television on, and immediately I looked at some of that footage and thought, I can't watch this. I can't. You know, I was one of those people who was so traumatized by 9/11 that I just don't want to watch that stuff on television anymore. I don't want to be confronted. And the fact that it gets played over and over again, and I knew what sort of an impact it would have on me emotionally.
Yeah.
And so I switched the television off, and I never switched it back on again.
Wow.
And so all of my understanding of what's gone on in Christchurch has been through friends and family telling me what's happened.
Yeah.
Watching your film was the first time that I'd seen pictures of Christchurch and images of the devastation and the hesitant recovery since that switching their television off back in February, and I was profoundly moved, and I think it needed for me that time, you know, before I could actually sort of watch it without it having a massive effect on my own emotional state.
You know, you're a bit like people in Christchurch, Dan, who had no power.
Yeah.
So people in Christchurch couldn't see it.
Yeah.
You know, we were having friends ring us, telling us what's happening around the corner because they were watching it on television in Auckland. You know, but where we were inside the maelstrom, you know, and so I guess the film is an inside view. A lot of Christchurch people would be like you, although that said, a lot of people have seen it on YouTube and whatever, but the live television experience wasn't ours.
Right. And so in terms of the response to the film that you're getting, it would be very different from those people who lived through it in Christchurch as opposed to people like myself who have only ever had secondhand sort of information. The emotional response, do you feel like people are ready in Christchurch to revisit it now?
Yeah, that's the big question, and there's the great debates going on Facebook about it. If you look at our site, When a City Falls, there are people arguing galore about whether it is. Interestingly, we invited 470 people to a premiere at the newly opened Readings at the Palm Cinema in Christchurch last week. No one turned down the invitation, and a lot of these people were the people who had a torrid time coming to, you know, they were speaking in the film and they were coming to the premiere. I think everyone came who was invited, but what was neat for us to see was that afterwards when people came out of the cinema, they were animated. People were yakking. We were meant to have a series of speeches afterwards. We canned it because everyone was up partying. And that was cool. And then I thought, it's worked.
Well, that's interesting because in Wellington on Monday night, at the screening we had, it was the first time that I've ever been in a screening where no one said a word.
Really?
Yeah. It was dead silent through the whole of the closing credits, and we all just sort of got up and filed out. People didn't really know quite how to respond to it, so I don't think.
It's almost like your Christchurch screening might have been a form of closure.
You know? Well, it gave us hope. We, at the end of the film, we go to the States and we talk to people who have been through Katrina, and 6 years later, and they say, no, this is what happened to us, and this is what might happen to you, and there's good news coming. And, you know, New Orleans is, you know, this really has been a silver lining. We went to San Francisco where they had the San Andreas Fault, the earthquake in the 90s, and they talked about staying there and becoming more resilient against such things. We tried to make it a hopeful film in the last quarter. We tried to have that sense of some sort of redemption, and I think it, hopefully that worked.
I think one of the things that is extraordinary about the film, and in a relatively short space of time, is that you touch on, I think, all of the issues that, at least that I was aware of, that that have come out of the earthquake experience, whether it's the people having their buildings demolished without any notice. I guess all the question marks about what sort of, about how so much of Christchurch could be built on land that would liquefy the way that it did. You know, there's some, and so I think that, you know, in a 2-hour spread, you cover an enormous amount of ground. I think it's a very efficient piece of work. But I think there's a lot of those issues that are going to be delved into more deeply as time goes on.
We had a cutoff. I mean, there's a lot of stuff we could have talked about. Insurance is a big thing. We don't go anywhere near. But these are looming issues.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, we're not into the politics of it. We keep politicians almost right out of the story. We keep figures of authority almost out of the story. We keep facts almost out of the story. Essential ones, absolutely. We don't name many people.
No.
It's from the heart, I hope, you know. It's how people felt and are feeling.
Another thing that occurred to me watching the film was the extent to which from a heritage point of view, the biggest losers are the churches in Christchurch, and yet they were almost the ones that gave the most in terms of emergency recovery and support. You know, that they
I don't know whether I agree so much there, because it might be rude to say, but the old culture churches weren't very full.
Oh, okay.
You know, the old cathedral-type churches had 38 parishioners, and mostly in their 80s. It's the young people, charismatic sort of churches, who are pretty energised and doing a lot of stuff. You know, the Salvation Army don't have a huge cathedral, but, you know, they're out on the streets working.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's churches and churches, maybe.
The community mobilisation was a very clear and powerful part of your story.
And that was...
And does that continue to this day?
I think so. You know, you can easily exaggerate it and make it seemingly blissful, but the thing about Christchurch is that we're intergenerational. The people who have stayed in Christchurch, like me, like most of my siblings, most of my cousins, most of my friends, left Christchurch as soon as they could in their 20s. And, you know, Christchurch people have relatives all over the world. Those of us who stay still have aunties, grandmas. We're intergenerational in Christchurch. There are very, very deep and profound, you know, networks and contacts. So when something like this happens, we know how to rely on each other. We're quite a connected tribe, and that came into play. That was our strength. So that resilient thing, yeah, I think we did look after each other. And the other side of that is that in a disaster, I think it's well known that as human beings, we fairly quickly realise that if we bond up with someone near us, we have a stronger chance of survival. So falling in love with your neighbour was a pretty practiced thing around the city. Plus, given the fact that you've got no power and you've got a lot of time on your hands, you're sitting around having a drink a lot. And there were street loads of people getting pissed for weeks and loving each other.
The film is opening nationwide on Thursday.
Yeah.
And you said that there was over 50 cinemas around the country that picked it up.
Yes, indeed. From multiplexes now in all the cities. I think Hoyt's event and Reading's are doing a fantastic job. Right down to the little coffee and couch cinemas in Hokitika and wherever. Everyone's asking for it, and we're doing our best to send it out.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And what's the what can you see much beyond the next fortnight? What do you think? What are your plans for the film? Is there a?
Well, we're getting a lot of people. We're learning very quickly. Look, we finished the film 2 weeks ago. You know, it's just been such a rush. I haven't had a day off in a year, really. It's gone crazy. And it's being reviewed on the BBC next week. We're getting requests from Australia every hour for, you know, I think I think it's true that there are 6 million New Zealanders, 4 million of us live in New Zealand, so there's 2 million New Zealanders maybe wanting to see it. So we're learning about when to go to DVD, when it's theatrical. Obviously you don't do them at the same time, and then other opportunities later.
It occurs to me, I think I asked you before we came on air about, or maybe it was even at the beginning of this interview, whether it was always intended to be a cinema,
yes,
a cinema experience. And it occurs to me with what you've said about communities and bonding together, that perhaps this isn't the best film to sit at home on your own and watch, that it is actually a film to experience with a whole lot of other people.
That's what we thought when we were making it. I mean, it's a bit trite to say group therapy, but it is quite comforting. The thing in Christchurch is that we like sitting with each other now. You know, we've become a very communal people, and that's sticking. You know, once you actually do get to know your neighbours, you can't get to unknow them. And so we all are a lot closer. And going to a theatre or something, we don't have many things we can do. A lot of restaurants are gone, a lot of pubs are gone, a lot of other, you know, swimming pools and other gathering places are gone. So to go to a movie is something you can do. And that's hopefully what Christchurch people might do.
Jared Smythe, thanks very much for coming down and talking to us on Cinematica.
Corker, thank you.
Jordana Bevan's moderately unpopular, which makes a romance between the two of us more likely.
Meet me under the bridge after school and we'll take you from there.
I asked if she was my girlfriend now. She said,
I'll think about it.
But what she meant was, yes, we are now as one.
My parents are going to the cinema on Thursday. The house is empty on Thursday evening.
Are you asking me to come round and have sex with you?
If I say yes, does that lessen the chance of you wanting to?
To us, and a wonderful evening of lovemaking.
You're a serial killer.
Welcome back to Cinematica. And that was a little bit of audio from the forthcoming film Submarine. Hayley, you're a submarine expert.
I suppose, yes. I saw Submarine at the film festival this year and I did enjoy it. So this is a bit of a preview one because it
doesn't open
until
Thursday, yeah.
Yeah, so we're ahead of the game.
We are. We're in the future.
Woo! All right, so the basic synopsis is 15-year-old Oliver Tate has two objectives, to lose his virginity before his next birthday and to extinguish the flame between his mother and an ex-lover who has resurfaced in her life. Now, for those film fans out there who liked those kind of quirky hipster movies along the lines of Juno and Napoleon Dynamite, kind of with the loser coming out on top, this
quirky,
is definitely
quirky women, quirky young women.
Yes, quirky young women and quirky gentlemen, mm-hmm. as well as stars. I think this is a movie for you. It was directed by Richard Ayoade, I believe, from the IT Crowd, and he's also a music video director. So that I found that in this film, that music video aesthetic really came through and kind of reflected in that with the strong titles and the strong. Sorry, there's bugs in here. And the strong
we're being attacked by flies.
Yes. And the set design and how things are going. It's based in the 70s,
80s.
Yes.
I know you weren't really alive, yeah. Dan, but we'll have to say it was
it's a
the
long
80s.
Time ago.
Oh, yes. so it does have some really kind of funky, interesting aesthetics to it. But unfortunately, I didn't really find it a strong first film because, you know, there's like Spike Jonze with his Where the Wild Things Are, and he's done a number of shorts, came out of music videos, is quite a strong director, I found, for his features and shorts that he's done. But I'm sorry, Richard, it just did not quite catch me. It was a bit too hipster. There's too many layers of like irony and kitsch in it, and
kitsch, yes, yeah. Good call.
And it was, yeah, I enjoyed it, but it was not my piece of cake.
I'm going to preface my comments by admitting to the fact that I was watching a downloaded version, legitimately downloaded,
yes,
through the iTunes store, but for awful internet-y reasons, I only got to watch an hour last night before I had to go to bed. So bear in mind that I don't know how it finishes. I'm going to try and watch the rest of it tonight. But I felt a little bit, as you did, that we've sort of seen all this before. We've seen these characters. We've seen this sort of sensitive teenage boy wanting to find his way in the world, magical pixie girl creature who doesn't appear to have any kind of relationship to the real world at all. And it's a sort of fantasy world, isn't it? And so, yeah, I get the feeling that I'm not as down on the director as you are. I get the feeling that he, with stronger source material, is going to do some really good stuff in the future, and it's a good calling card on that basis. But, yeah, I do really feel like we've seen all this before.
Mm.
Just in terms of the style, though, I want to draw your attention to the editor, Chris Dickens, his responsible for the editing on Slumdog Millionaire, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, Paul, and I think a lot of that visual style you can put down to Chris Dickens, who is the business. As I reckon he's the best editor working in the world today, and quite often I can watch a film and think, you know, there's something really, really good about this editing. What's the name? And look him up, and there he is, Chris Dickens. And so, yeah, I get the feeling that that a lot of the strengths of the film aren't necessarily those of the director.
Mm-hmm.
So, two words.
My two-word review is Young Art House, and we had a tweet review come in today as well.
Goody.
Yes. And that tweet review was Hipster Overload.
Nice. My two words for Submarine are Rushmore Boyo.
Trust me, you're not safe. Accidents do happen.
You need an armored security vehicle? What the hell they do?
None of your business.
Why do you want to get rid of her?
I have to protect this organization.
You've been ordered out of this mission.
Doesn't matter who I work for, I wouldn't let anybody get away with this.
Top-level military commanders are pulling your files.
We have a system that works here.
Oh, really? For who?
Are you sure you want to go ahead with this? You know there'll be no going back.
I don't want a scandal. I'm just doing my job.
I have to say that that makes The Whistleblower sound like the most exciting thing ever. That trailer, very a most excellent trailer. The Whistleblower, we're again in the future. That opens on Thursday nationwide across New Zealand. And Simon.
Yes. Rachel Weisz plays this police officer in Nebraska who's kind of struggling a little bit to hold her family life together, I guess. Like, she is separated and she's looking after her, you know, but also sharing her daughter. But they're about to move away, and the cost of sort of sticking with them is quite high. And the idea comes along of her joining the United Nations peacekeeping sort of private police in
yeah,
Bosnia.
It's a complicated sort of arrangement, isn't it?
It is,
so she's sort of an observer.
Yes, she is. And I think the money beckons, but also I think there's a part of her, it's quite interesting, I think there's a part of her also that just wants to seek that adventure and get off and do something like that.
And she's a very dedicated policewoman as well. Mm. So I think that the challenge, you know, she's a serious sort of professional.
She is. And it's interesting that once she actually mixes it with the rest of her kind of team, you know, they come from very different backgrounds, not necessarily all from the police. And it's a sort of motley crew in that respect.
Yep.
And I quite like this film, and it was quite sort of, you know, it was quite insightful. And this is sort of based on real events and sort of delves into the sex trade in Bosnia.
People trafficking
and how, you know, people within the United Nations were kind of involved and knew and made money out of it.
Exactly. And because of their status, they had diplomatic immunity, which meant that even though she found out what was going on, she couldn't actually bring any of those people to justice, and hence the whistleblower part of the title. She had to basically go to the media to try and tell the story. I was reminded of Oranges and Sunshine, actually, because I thought that it was a similar sort of story, a dedicated professional woman discovering a scandal and then having that scandal overtake her life, really, to the extent that she had, you know, in The Whistleblower, she stops thinking about her kids, doesn't she, really?
She does, yeah.
About halfway through the film, you think, hang on, shouldn't you be ringing your, you know, it's gone. Forget about it.
But that's her character in a way, in that she's very focused and she'll see it through, and she has made this commitment. And I think it does kind of reflect the commitment that she's making to her daughter. Is kind of, in a way, she's seeing a little bit of her daughter and not wanting that type of thing to ever happen, and that's why she follows through on it. So I thought it was, you know, it was quite an interesting wee film. The cast in there is quite good. You know, Vanessa Redgrave,
David Strathairn, who's always very, very solid, isn't he?
Yeah, and so it was well put together, but maybe possibly a tad long. But, you know, that's always
Yeah, and but intelligent, an intelligent sort of thoughtful thriller, which we've been talking about before on the show, don't come along very often, and also a very good, strong central female character, you know, again, which we applaud, don't we?
Yeah, a good choice for her, and an interesting one for her to take and do, I guess, but a very interesting choice, and she's really good in it.
She is, she's fantastic. My only problem with the film really was the director just wouldn't stop moving the damn camera, and you know there was a lot of that shaky cam that does my head in quite often, and even when there's something, you know, relatively static, the camera would be sort of swooping around, or and so my two word review of The Whistleblower is stop moving.
Mine's interesting drama.
Yes, and I didn't get a chance to see it, but I'm really looking forward to it because I love Rachel Weisz. Mm.
She is fantastic, isn't she, Rachel Weisz? Absolutely. Right, well, that's the end of another Cinematica podcast. And thank you very much. Hope you've enjoyed the show. On next week's show, we start the countdown to what our American friends call the holidays with Arthur Christmas, big screen ancient world action with immortals. That's I've seen the trailer so often I'm really not looking forward to it, but I've heard some quite interesting things actually about immortals, so who knows, that could be a bonus. And of course there's also another little Kiwi battler, the Rest Home Whodunit, Rest for the Wicked. So that's all on next week's show. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us feedback at the iTunes store. Remember, you can subscribe because that's how episodes are downloaded automatically. You don't have to think about it. The ratings and reviews from our listeners are super useful to help more people discover the show. It's very, very important that you do that. We have currently 8 5-star reviews, but I think they're all from us and members of our family. So it would be really nice if some ordinary citizens could get in there and give us some good ratings and reviews. And remember it on Twitter, CinematicaCast is our handle. You can also check out the website at cinematica.co.nz. The show is executive produced by Simon Wherry, edited and produced by me, Dan Slevin, the news editor, and weather girl is Kaylee Carruthers. Our theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some John Williams. This is the theme to Tintin. Anybody got anything to add? My co-hosts are raising eyebrows at that.
Wait for you to pitch to us.
It's good night from me.
Yes, it's good night from me, Kaylee Carruthers.
Oh, there we go. What a pleasure it's been sharing the show.
I think
we
were just mesmerised by what
John Williams.
By
exactly.
Your radio voice.
Oh, I know what I was thinking on the car in the car on the way in. Everybody remembers how Star Wars goes, you know, da 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 da, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. How does that one go? Yep, well done. And but can anybody remember Superman? That's the other big John Williams one. I could not remember Superman.
It's probably
on the
a
way
blend
in
of the two.
Well, that's what they say, isn't it?
That he no, is it?
All right, thanks very much everybody for listening. We'll see you again same time next week. This has been the Cinematica podcast. Cheerio.